cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
The U.S. doesn't have a great track record when it comes to maternal health. Here's some numbers. The U.S. maternal mortality rate is far higher than peer countries, and it soared during the pandemic. More than 1,200 women in the U.S. died of complications arising from pregnancy or childbirth in 2021. It was a 40% jump from 2020. That's according to the most recently available data from the CDC. I should note, there was a recent study that called into question some of the CDC data and methodology around it, but the upshot was still the same. The U.S. lags other high-income countries when it comes to maternal mortality.
Which is kind of interesting because we're all often talking about healthcare costs, but it's also a reminder that not everybody gets the same kind of healthcare. Hey, one company that's out there hoping to improve maternity care is Millie. It's a venture-backed company that provides pregnant people with midwives, doulas, remote health monitoring, and a lot more. Sarah Reynolds is co-founder and chief technology officer at Millie, and she joins us from the Bay Area. Sarah, great to have you here with us. Tell us a little bit more about what you guys are doing. Tell us about your platform.
Thanks for having me. So at Millie, we are trying to build on top of the current system of U.S. healthcare, really incorporating some of our past experiences, as well as really some of the top of the line clinical practices with our team. So, you know, we are trying to bring midwifery-led care to a place where really it can reach far more in the United States than it has in the past, but also to incorporate good uses of technology, both to enable us to scale that care, but also to reach patients where they are and enable them to have real top-of-the-line care that they may not be able to access otherwise.
What I find interesting in preparing for this, Sarah, is that it's you're the CTO. You consider yourself not necessarily a healthcare company. You work with insurance companies, but you position it as a tech company. Can you talk a little bit about that distinction? Because when we talk about the services that are offered, at the end of the day, they are all about health.
Yes, and we do consider ourselves a truly hybrid healthcare and tech company. There are other companies in the maternal health space that are digital only. We do offer the full line of in-person maternity care services, accepting most major insurance, including Medi-Cal. And that's actually very important to us to be able to make sure that we are truly equitable in our approach. However, we do think that in order to do so and in order to address these problems of maternal mortality that you've summarized, you know, we need the ability to reach people where they are. And there's no better way to do that than technology in the current system. You know, it's very hard for people in vast areas of the country to access in-person services. So wherever we can manage to close that gap, is really important to getting people the most important baseline quality care.
Hey, Sarah, what do you think is the thing that holds people back from getting this kind of access? Is it healthcare coverage? Is it money? Is it access, physical access or virtual access? Is it information and education? What is it that you think or that you guys have found out in starting this platform that prevents people from getting the right care, especially when it comes to maternity care?
So indeed, as you've called out, there can be a mix of factors. Physical access is actually a real problem in the United States for maternity care. You know, there are a large number of what we call maternal care deserts that, you know, are more than an hour or even 2 hours drive from a labor and delivery facility. And when you consider how important it is throughout pregnancy to be checking in, you know, via ultrasound or other metrics on the health of the mother, you know, it really comes to see, you know, it can be a very difficult thing for folks to access from a physical perspective. Now, this can also be true technologically if we rely on solutions that are, you know, overly intensive on, you know, high bandwidth or high quality internet service. So, you know, solutions that can roll out via SMS are a really interesting
If I can just follow for a second, because it's certainly something we've talked about and our teams have reported on, is just the amount of investor money or private equity money that are in healthcare systems and systems that are being, whether it's hospitals or medical facilities that are either being shut down or people shut out. Is that part of what you guys are, why you're doing what you're doing?
Absolutely. Being able to provide quality care at, you know, a realistic cost given the constraints of the current system is something we're working with. And so, you know, midwives being very highly trained, competent, and also caring health professionals and being able to, you know, really use that their talents as much as we can to reach as many people as possible. Also with, you know, the knowing that, you know, the world has changed after COVID and, you know, people have more expectations about being able to access telehealth services, is also part of, our approach.
Hey, Sarah, I was struck by, just how bad we are in the U.S. when it comes to maternal mortality. I have two questions on that. One is, what is the cause of the maternal mortality rate in the U.S. putting us beyond our peers? We just don't compare to them. And two, give us some data about how this type of intervention that you're doing at Millie is actually working. Like, how do you know that what you're doing is working?
Right. So I think I can, you know, we should probably speak to your first question. You know, the maternal mortality rate in the U.S., you know, is definitely going to reflect these infrastructural problems that we've talked about earlier, you know, the lack of access, as well as underlying health conditions that have gone untreated in the United States due to difficulties across our healthcare system. A lot of issues with pregnancy can happen with pre-existing hypertension, for example, or diabetes. And, you know, these kind of systemic health issues are certainly playing a role, as well as, you know, variable access to insurance and quality care. In terms of our approach and our data, you know, we have a kind of a collection of interventions that we call our care model, and we're collecting data about folks, you know, to be able to address these questions. So we monitor blood pressure, for example, remotely, and we take other measurements, you know, of our patients throughout their time. And so we can also connect their engagement with our services and our applications to the outcomes that they have, because we also manage their labor and deliveries. So we can measure things like C-section rate, NICU stay for babies, and other complications that may develop. So we're pretty tightly tied into that, and also, you know, always keeping up on how we can, you know, stay
Sarah, forgive me for breaking in because we've just got 30 seconds left. How many people are using your website or using the platform? Just give us an idea.
Yeah, so
real quickly,
we have, you know, we would say many folks who are actually coming through our clinic. We also have an additional pool for virtual services.
Right.
But we're now at about I would say 1,000 patients or so that have come through our clinic in Berkeley.
Okay, going to leave it there. Interesting. Sarah Reynolds, thank you so much. Co-founder, Chief Technology Officer over at Millie, joining us from the Bay Area. Really a connection, if you will, between healthcare and technology, right? Something we've seen before, but really you see what they're trying to do.
No question. We need that to be improved.
Got to figure it out.
Yeah,
access.
We have to figure it out.
You know, we talk about different kinds of deserts, and there's definitely a healthcare desert in many parts of the country. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I have to say, our next guest looks at the contrasts that are going on in society and the crises that the world has dealt with in the recent past, from the great financial crisis to the pandemic and more. She has written about them. With us is journalist and author Grace Blakely. She has written about the corona crash. She has also talked about Stolen, How to Save the World from Financializationism. I'm not sure I'm getting that correctly right. But her
latest that's book, about right.
Is it right? Come on in. Talk about your latest book. Financialization is, I think, what you said, or the book is about. Your latest book is, though, Vulture Capitalism, Corporate Crimes, Backdoor Bailouts, and the Death of Freedom. You really are looking, though, Grace, and great to have you here with us. I feel like the conversation and your book is very timely. You're looking at crises and kind of maybe some of the layers it peels back on society or reveals on society. Talk to us about this latest book and what it's all about.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. So really what I'm looking at in the book, as you say, often I use the lens of crises to show, really to expose the way that capitalism really works. Because I think that we have this idea in our heads of the economic system in which we live as kind of meaning free markets and democracy, right? That we live in these kind of free market economies. And if there are problems within the market, then it's up to the government to kind of put things right. And what I show in the book is that actually capitalism most of the time doesn't mean free markets. It means concentrated monopolistic power.
You don't think we're free at all, do you?
I really don't, no. And part of the problem is that governments don't really act as a check on corporate power. Most of the time, they reinforce the power of big businesses. The big example at the moment is Boeing. So Boeing's obviously been through this horrendous time, loads of corporate scandals, massive cover-ups over the issues that that have been besetting its planes. And it's one of the biggest recipients of corporate welfare in the US. It gets tax subsidies, it gets tax breaks, and it's got loads and loads of government contracts. It got a big bailout during the pandemic,
right,
even after the 737 MAX disasters.
I will point out, Grace, that Airbus, the European rival to Boeing, it is a duopoly, I think it's fair to say, also does get some of those same favorable treatment. It's
totally
been the subject of WTO issues. Would you say that Airbus has the same issue that Boeing does? Would you characterize
some
it the same way?
Some of the same issues, definitely. Yeah, totally. So, I mean, I look at this actually, how these two aerospace manufacturers have become so deeply interwoven with the US state on the one hand and the European Union and various states within that on the other hand. And Airbus has also been embroiled in corruption scandals. So, you know, these two giant firms, as you say, in this duopolistic market structure, with Boeing obviously having dealt with some serious safety failings, Airbus dealing with some corruption scandals, it kind of shows that this line between states and markets isn't really as clear as we'd like to think.
It's interesting, you know, where we are often talking about our data and data privacy and control of our own data when it comes to the social media world, whether it's TikTok, whether it's other social media companies, and how our own data, which is very valuable and has made some very large market cap companies out there and made a lot of companies, if you will, very wealthy in the process. It's interesting, though, that this idea of, you know, kind of taking back our economy is something that you are digging into. I mean, do you not like capitalism at all? Do you think it's all bad?
Well, to be clear to your listeners, I am a socialist, so I'll put that
out of the way early.
I know it's kind of a bit more of a dirty word in the US than it is in the UK. But I think even if you're not a socialist or even a progressive, my analysis is still relevant because it's something that, you know, libertarians, for example, have been saying in the US for a very long time. It's that we don't have real capitalism. We have crony capitalism, right? It's a kind of perversion of a free market system. And what I show in the book using loads of historical examples is actually this has kind of always been the case. So it's always been the case that big businesses have worked with and through governments basically to get their way all the way back.
Think of the robber barons, right? Or going back even further.
Well, Grace, I think critics might say, okay, I understand the criticisms that you have of capitalism, but show me a better system out there. Mm-hmm. Can you show us a better system?
Yeah, so the third part of my book is really dedicated to thinking about alternatives. And I actually start at the grassroots and community level. Because, I mean, if you think about it logically, there's this fusion of public and private power in the economy. You can't just rely on the state to do things to kind of contain what's going on in the economy. So what is the alternative? You have to build people power. You have to build power from the ground up. So that means making sure that workers are able to organize within their organizations, but also have a voice within how those organizations are run. You know, when you have more democratic processes within corporations, like, you know, workers on boards in Germany, for example, they actually perform a lot better and the whole system is fairer. But I also look at a lot of examples of like communities organizing in their local area to build a kind of fairer local economy. So we've got this idea of community wealth building. There are examples of this in the UK and in the US and really like, you know, downtrodden places like Detroit, for example, where local groups have come together and they've built cooperatives, they've built community energy companies, they've built community banks, and they've started to say, how can we make our economy work for us instead of the big businesses and actually politicians?
I want to get back to our guest, journalist and author Grace Blakely. Her latest book, Vulture Capitalism, Corporate Crimes, Backdoor Bailouts, and the Death of Freedom. She's still with us from the UK. I got to say, Grace, Tim and I are having conversations in the break about your book and your thinking. You said, I'm a socialist. You are a socialist. I'm not. And we're talking a lot about capitalism. And in your book, like early on in the introduction, you talk specifically about capitalism and this balance between markets and planning, and that the planning part of the equation is really important, right? How it's being executed, whose interests it is serving. And I mean, is this where kind of capitalism has gotten into trouble? There are companies out there that are great for their workers, provide pensions still, great healthcare, great this, great that. Like, where did the disconnect happen in your view that things kind of was more in the favor maybe of owners or shareholders or senior executive versus a lot of the folks that are actually on the line doing a lot of the work?
Well, we know when this big shift happened because we saw it in the inequality statistics, in, you know, the wealth that was being accrued at the top of the economy and the size of the financial sector, in things like share buybacks and dividends. All of these things started booming in the 1980s when you had this big deregulation of the economy, or should I say re-regulation of the economy. I think there's this sense that the changes that were brought in the 1980s, so things like privatization, changing to regulation, tax cuts, etc. There's this idea that that was about shrinking the state and boosting the power of the market. And in fact, what you saw was not the state becoming smaller, it was just the state becoming smaller for some people, generally workers, and very, very big for the kind of the corporate class and the financial class as well. And the most obvious manifestation of this was, of course, the massive bailouts after the banking crisis. But you saw this all throughout the pandemic as well. I did some research just looking into the astonishing levels of actually corruption I don't think there's another word for it that characterized some of the stimulus packages in the US and also in other parts of the world, where you had, you know, government funding going to firms that were owned by Congress people, and then those firms donating tons of money to the re-election campaigns of those Congress people. So, you know, this idea that the changes that we had that led to, you know, rising inequality and, you know, this big shift in power in the economy, that was all legitimate because it was about promoting the free market.
To be sure, and to be fair, though, right, during the pandemic, different from many would argue what happened in the great financial crisis, where the money went straight to companies versus Main Street, right? We know a lot of people losing homes and so on and so forth weren't getting the assistance that the banks were getting and other companies were getting, if you will. During the pandemic, money did go, though, to Main Street. We still talk about it, you know, that support has stayed with a lot of individuals and households for years coming off the pandemic. So to be fair, individuals also got it as well.
Well, yes, but a lot of that just went straight through to paying back debt, so it ended up with the banks, or paying rent, so it ended up with landlords. And actually, there's this really interesting case study of a couple of big corporate landlords in the US that received tons of government funding throughout the pandemic and were told to kind of enforce this evictions moratorium that was supposed to be implemented. And there's this fascinating example of this corporate landlord that I look at in the book that basically used the uncertainty around the pandemic to scare people out of rental accommodation, mm-hmm. basically telling their tenants that the evictions moratorium wasn't being enforced and that they would be kicked out if they didn't leave voluntarily, at the same time as receiving government funding, which I think was really just horrifying.
Grace, it's so interesting to hear you speak and also to see in the book. I think politically, at least here in the U.S., you wouldn't necessarily be surprised to hear former President Trump bring up some of these points at rallies. Mm. And indeed, this idea of populism that has caught on here in the United States over the last 8 years or so in response to what we saw after the great financial crisis. Talk a little bit about the Venn diagram and the sort of the strange bedfellows, one could argue, with socialism and the way that you describe it, and then also with populism.
This is kind of why I wrote the book, because people like Donald Trump succeed when the average person feels really, really powerless. And you see this in the UK as well, you know, extremist politicians doing well. And when you ask people why they vote for these people, it's basically them saying, I don't have any control over my life. The system is rigged. So they feel powerless and they project their sense of political agency onto these strong figures that say, I'm going to burn the whole system down. Most of the time, those strong figures, those anti-establishment figures, come very much from within the establishment. And, you know, people like Trump says, I'm going to drain the swamp, and then goes in and delivers this massive package of tax cuts that massively benefits big corporations and big businesses and does very little, actually, for the average American. But this anger that bubbles up beneath the surface of our very unequal economies ends up feeding into the rise of the far right and the rise of a kind of extremist populist politicians if we aren't able to identify it and provide an explanation that isn't just conspiracy theories. And I, you know, this is such a big thing now post-pandemic. It's like conspiracy theories about who's running the world economy and you know, like the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset and things.
Oh yeah.
And I think all of that feeds into this sense of like, we're powerless. We know that lots of stuff is going on up there in the clouds, but we don't feel that we can control it.
Well, and I feel like it's always like follow the money. Like whenever there's money involved, it feels like that's how the gaps in many ways can often widen. Grace, we unfortunately only have about a minute left here. So what's the way forward in your view? If we don't want to become socialists and continue to operate under a capitalistic society, what's the way forward in your view? And got about a minute left here.
So I think the key thing here is accountability. Capitalism is supposed to have markets to enforce accountability, to make sure that corporations can't get too big, that the rich can't get too rich, because there are all these checks and balances. But we don't really have those right now. So the question is, how do we enforce accountability? And that has to come through real democracy, democracy in our corporations, democracy in our communities, democracy in our governments, everywhere throughout society. And that's really what I
want
to see.
But if they don't want it, how do you get it? Those are the folks in power. As I remember coming off of the pandemic and George Floyd, about people who said, I don't have a seat at the table to help change things. And these were Black individuals, people who don't have a seat at the table. How do you change things? Again, just about 30 seconds. Forgive me.
You got to make trouble. They're not going to give power away. You have to build power from the ground up. Whether you're a unionist and you want a seat at the table, you've got to organize in your workplace. If in your community you're being exploited or oppressed, again, we've got to organize. We've got to try and build alternative structures. And again, not just protest, but really seeing ways that communities can come together and say, we're going to change the way our economy works.
I feel like another relevant conversation for our times. Grace, stop by again. I'd love to continue with you guys, with you specifically, rather, this conversation. Grace Blakely, her new book, Vulture Capitalism, Corporate Crimes, Backdoor Bailouts, and the Death of Freedom.
Really interesting stuff.
Right?
Yeah.
Are you ready to be a socialist?
I'm ready to talk more to Grace.
I'm ready to talk more to Grace, too. All right, this is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.